The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Heart Letter, and we're completing the Harvard Heart Letter of March 2025. And I'm going to read the third section from Research We're Watching. And what this says is, brief bursts of vigorous activity are linked to lower heart risks. Among women who don't exercise, briefly running or climbing stairs a few times a day was linked to a lower risk of serious heart-related problems, a new study finds. This kind of high-intensity physical activity done as a result of daily routine is known as vigorous intermittent lifestyle physical activity, or VILPA. Researchers relied on data from more than 22,000 self-proclaimed non-exercisers age 40 to 79. 60% were women. All the participants wore activity trackers 24 hours a day for a week between 2013 and 2015. Based on hospital and death records through November 2022, researchers found that women who averaged 3.4 minutes of VILPA per day were half as likely to later have a heart attack or serious heart-related problem compared to women who did no VILPA. Even lower amounts of VILPA were linked to a lower risk of heart-related problems in women. For unclear reasons, the benefits of VILPA were far less pronounced among men. More research is needed to understand how VILPA may improve heart health, say the authors, whose study was published in the December 2024 issue of the British Journal of Sports Medicine. Next, we're going to read an interesting article in the Harvard Heart Letter that's called A Heart Disease Trigger That Lurks Inside the Bone Marrow. This recently recognized risk factor goes by the acronym CHIP, C-H-I-P. Every day, stem cells in our bone marrow churn out tens of thousands of progeny that replenish the white and red blood cells that circulate throughout the body. As we age, spontaneous genetic mutations can arise in these bone marrow cells. These mutated cells then make multiple clones, a process called clonal hematopoiesis. By age 70, about 10 to 20% of people have clonal hematopoiesis, and the prevalence of this condition rises steeply with increasing age. Although it can predispose people to leukemia and related cancers, most people with it remain cancer-free and never even know they have clonal hematopoiesis. But over the past decade or so, scientists have discovered that one form called clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential, CHIP, is associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Peter Libby, the Mallinckrodt Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, has published numerous articles about CHIP. In 2020, he established one of the nation's few CHIP cardiovascular disease clinics at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And in this article, he explains more about this burgeoning field of study. The first question is, what causes the mutations that occur in people with CHIP? And Dr. Libby says, these mutations are not the type that we inherit from our parents, which are known as germline mutations. Rather, they are somatic mutations which arise later in life, spontaneously or due to environmental factors. We're exposed to environmental mutagens like air pollution, cosmic radiation, and chemicals throughout our lives. That's a major reason why these mutations accumulate and become more common with age. Many cases of cancer are thought to stem from somatic mutations. There are more than 40 such mutations linked to leukemia, a blood cancer that typically affects white blood cells. But because you need at least three distinct mutations in the same clone to develop full-blown leukemia, rates of this cancer are less than 1% per year among people with CHIP. Question: what's the connection to heart disease? The link was discovered more than a decade ago by Dr. Benjamin Ebert, CEO of Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. While researching the origins of leukemia, he found people without leukemia who had just one or two of the leukemia-associated mutations. It turns out that some of these mutations increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. That's why we refer to these cells as having indeterminate potential, because they may never cause overt disease. Some of these mutations relate clearly to inflammation, a well-known contributor to the formation of fatty plaque inside arteries. But different mutations have different mechanisms of action, and people can have different burdens, that is, amounts of mutated cells. This diversity means it's going to be devilishly hard to do rigorous clinical trials, but we're working on it. Several large, long-term studies of heart disease have included genetic testing that reveals CHIP. Based on these data, it's been estimated that CHIP is associated with a twofold increase in risk for coronary artery disease and a 2.5-fold increase in the risk for stroke. How do people discover they have CHIP? Routine screening for CHIP is not currently recommended for healthy people. CHIP is most commonly discovered during genetic testing for cancer or blood-related disorders, like smoldering myeloma, a precancerous condition marked by a buildup of abnormal plasma cells in the bone marrow. People with a family history of cancer may also undergo testing for CHIP. Some very health-conscious people pay to have their entire genome sequenced and then find out they have CHIP. At present, there aren't any proven specific therapies for CHIP. Dr. Libby says that he reinforces the importance of a healthy diet and regular exercise, as I do for everyone. Unless a person has signs or symptoms of cardiovascular problem, we don't recommend routine stress testing or imaging tests. But people with CHIP likely benefit from careful monitoring and aggressive treatment of all heart-related risk factors, like blood pressure and cholesterol. Dr. Libby says that we're learning so much biology and fundamental science that has helped us understand the links between aging, heart disease, and cancer that were unsuspected a few years ago. The hope is that as we discover more, we'll develop genetically directed therapies to address the various specific mutations that cause CHIP. Now, let's go ahead and move to the Harvard Health Letter. This is the Harvard Health Letter of March 2025. And the first article is a quite useful one, which is entitled, "Macular Degeneration: Will a Supplement Cocktail Slow It Down?" Encouraging new findings suggest the AREDS2 formula might work even in late-stage dry AMD. AREDS2 is spelled capital A, capital R, capital E, capital D, capital S, 2. Age-related macular degeneration is the leading cause of vision loss for people aged 50 or older. AMD increases in prevalence as we get older. More than 40% of us have some form of the disease by the time we reach our 80s, says Dr. Joan Miller, a chair of ophthalmology at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear and at Harvard Medical School. The most common type of this vision-robbing disease is called dry AMD. It accounts for 90% of AMD cases, affecting about 20 million U.S. adults and hundreds of millions of people worldwide. Unfortunately, there's little we can do to stop this condition, especially when it reaches a later stage. What is macular degeneration? AMD blurs or even erases central vision. The disease occurs when cells break down in the macula, the central part of the retina, the tissue in the back of the eye that turns light into signals that brain reads as images. In dry AMD, the macula starts to thin and deteriorate as deposits of fat and protein called drusen accumulate behind the retina. This usually happens slowly. The early or intermittent stage might not have symptoms. The late advanced stage causes a central blurry spot in vision that grows larger with time. At that stage, AMD can become wet. In wet AMD, new abnormal blood vessels grow under and into the macula. The blood vessels leak and bleed, rapidly damaging light receptor cells and causing blurred central vision. Treatment depends on the type of AMD you have. For wet AMD, doctors inject medication into the eye that stops leakage and growth of abnormal new blood vessels in the macula. The medication, called anti-VEGF, was discovered and developed by biomedical scientists at Harvard and elsewhere, including Dr. Joan Miller. For dry AMD, treatment is limited to an attempt to slow disease progression. The most effective approach is combining a heart-healthy diet with a cocktail of antioxidant nutrients called the AREDS2 formula. The components of the AREDS2 formula fight free radicals, molecules abundant in the retina that cause oxidative stress. Studies have shown that the supplement combination may reduce dry AMD progression to the late stage by 25%. For years, doctors believed that the AREDS2 formula couldn't help people once they reached the late stage of AMD. However, that's now changing, based on findings of the January 2025 issue of Ophthalmology. Researchers analyzed data from more than 1,200 people involved in the two large AREDS studies who had been randomly assigned to either take a variation of the AREDS formula or a placebo. The researchers found that the supplement mix was able to slow the progression of retinal thinning in the center of the macula, although it didn't seem to slow the overall spread of damage. This sparing of the central macula corresponded to a slower loss of vision in those taking the supplement. The findings have made us rethink the use of the supplement, Dr. Miller says. We used to say it may not really help once you progress to a later form. Now I recommend the patients stay on it. Another recent development in dry AMD treatment is controversial. In 2023, the FDA approved the first drugs to treat late-stage AMD, the eye injections Syfovre and Izervay. The drugs were not approved by European authorities. Both FDA drug approvals were based on trials that showed slowing of retinal thinning, but neither drug showed any benefit in terms of vision function. and the medications increase the risk of AMD converting to wet AMD, which requires injections of anti-VEGF therapy. By comparison, the AREDS2 formula has been found to slow disease progression at the center of the eye and slow vision loss safely. Dr. Miller advises her patients with intermediate or late-stage dry AMD to take the AREDS2 supplement and practice healthy lifestyle habits that also might help reduce risk for eye disease, like exercising, eating a heart-healthy diet, not smoking, and controlling blood pressure. If you're interested in trying the new medications, Dr. Miller advises speaking with your retina specialist. She says the use of the drugs is hotly debated, with many specialists holding off, including those affiliated with Harvard Medical School. But we will likely hear more about medications to treat dry AMD and prevent the progression to its later stage, since other drugs are being studied for their ability to preserve retinal cells. Hopefully, Dr. Miller says, we'll have safer and more effective drugs coming out in the next few years. Now, let's turn to the Ask the Doctor section of the Harvard Health Letter of March 2025. And this is written by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who's the editor-in-chief. The first question is, I take antihistamines for allergies, and a friend said they can cause dementia. I want allergy relief, but not if the price is developing dementia. Should I worry? You raise an important question, but you might not like my answer, says Dr. Komaroff. I assume you'd like a definite answer like, no, don't worry, or yes, so look for another kind of treatment. However, all I can say is, based on conflicting evidence, maybe. Many frequently used medications, including non-prescription medications, have what is called anticholinergic effects. Examples include antihistamines and certain medicines to improve sleep, treat urinary incontinence, reduce nausea, ease tense muscles, or treat Parkinson's disease, medicines used by millions of people. Theoretically, these drugs might increase the risk of dementia by blocking a particular brain neurotransmitter or increasing brain inflammation. In the past decade, several studies have suggested that these pills might increase the risk of dementia, while other studies have found no risk. All the studies are inherently flawed. A flawless study is to answer the question, would involve recruiting many hundreds of identical twins. Starting in childhood, one of each twin pair would be allowed to use medications that had anticholinergic effects whenever necessary, while the other twin would be prohibited from doing so. This would continue for 60 years or more, and then you'd see if the twins who were allowed to use the medicines with anticholinergic effects were more likely to have developed dementia than the ones who weren't, after taking into account all the other factors in their lives that might increase dementia risk. Obviously, such a study would not be feasible. Even if it were, it would take 60 years to get an answer. Too long for you and me. So biomedical scientists are doing studies that are feasible, but that produce less than definitive answers. These studies involve following large numbers of people for several decades and keeping track of all the medicines they take, the results of their health exams, and the diseases they develop. These studies have come to different conclusions. So how do I put these mixed results together for myself? I think twice about taking antihistamines and other medications with anticholinergic effects. I weigh the symptom relief they give me against the possibility they may slightly increase my risk of developing dementia. I ask if there are other drugs that might also give me symptom relief without the theoretical risk of cognitive decline. I also use the lowest possible dose to get symptom relief. As more studies are published, I will keep you posted about the possible risks of these medications. Now, once again in the Harvard Health Letter, here's an article called Answers to Why You Itch All Over. It's hard to get through daily activities when you itch all over. The widespread discomfort called generalized itching is distracting and frustrating. To help navigate this challenge, we turn to Dr. Martina Porter, a dermatologist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. How concerning is generalized itching? Dr. Porter says, it's something we take seriously. It can have an extremely negative impact on someone's quality of life, particularly if it disturbs sleep. How common is this? Dr. Porter says, it's much more common than you'd expect. 8 to 16% of the total population report having generalized itching in the past 12 months. 20% of the population experienced generalized itching in their lifetime. What causes generalized itching? Dr. Porter says, generalized itching can be caused by dry skin, severe cases of certain skin conditions, or skin changes that occur with age. Widespread itching might also be due to conditions that don't have obvious signs on the skin. Examples include diabetes, thyroid disease, kidney disease, liver disease, cancer, blood disorders, nerve-related causes, and some psychiatric conditions. HIV infection and medications can also cause itch, as can pregnancy. Dr. Porter says that pinpointing the cause can require a lot of detective work. We take a thorough health history, ask about all signs and symptoms, and examine all of the skin. We check the lymph nodes to see if they're swollen. If so, that could be a sign of cancer. We consider the distribution of itching to figure out if this is really generalized, all over itching, which points to an internal cause, or just localized itching, which is usually due to an exposure the body is reacting to, or a nerve-related cause. When it really is generalized itching, we usually order blood tests to help identify suspected internal causes. Some people may also need imaging testing to look for signs of cancer, although that's very rare. It can take time to identify the cause, but we still try to treat the itch while we investigate. What kind of treatments are used? Dr. Porter says, treatment must be tailored to the underlying condition causing generalized itching. If you have diabetes or thyroid disease, we need to treat that. We might also prescribe topical, oral, or injectable medications to help with the itch, or phototherapy that uses properties of ultraviolet light to decrease inflammation and itch. Sometimes people are tempted to try and treat itching at home by taking antihistamines like Benadryl, Claritin, Allegra, or Zyrtec. These medications can be helpful for hives or allergic causes of itching, but we try to limit their use for generalized itching in old people because of a potential increased risk of dementia. Are there any home remedies? Dr. Porter says, dry skin can be very itchy, which makes generalized itching worse. So it's important to moisturize, particularly in the cold, less humid winter months. For those who suffer from very dry skin or eczema, we recommend specific showering and bathing techniques. Using lukewarm rather than hot water, using soap only on the armpits, genitals, feet, and face, and moisturizing everywhere immediately after bathing before your skin has a chance to fully dry. There are many over-the-counter options for moisturizers, and some contain menthol, pramoxine, camphor, or capsaicin. Those ingredients can help alter nerve signaling and may decrease itch signaling. Although some ingredients may instead cause a burning, numbing, or cooling sensation. Applying over-the-counter 1% hydrocortisone cream or ointment can help to calm mild inflammation if itching is worse in a particular spot. Is it possible to stop the itch? Dr. Porter says, yes, you don't have to suffer with constant itching. Make an appointment with a dermatologist. Be sure to tell the doctor where the itching is occurring and try some home remedies until your visit. There is a short article attached that says, seasonal allergies are the result of an overactive immune system, one that reacts against harmless foreign substances like tree or plant pollen as if they were a dangerous threat. If you have allergies, when you breathe in tiny pollen particles or other allergens, immune cells in the nose release chemicals that trigger allergy symptoms and recruit more immune cells to fight. The bigger the battle that your immune system wages, the worse you are going to feel. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.